Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us. People coming in, have a seat. Welcome to How to Lose Co-Founders and Alienate Startups. My name is Alex. I'm very excited to be your moderator this afternoon. I've been working in startups for over a year and a half now and gone through my own co-founder disaster. And in a past life, mediated a lot of interpersonal and team issues in a corporate setting. So this is an issue really near and dear to my heart. We're going to only spend about 15 minutes actually speaking up here and spend the rest of the time answering your questions, because I think the real meat of it comes out when you ask for specifics and talk about what really matters. So one of the things, about 2-3 days ago, we were talking about how common this issue actually is, and we decided to pull together a quick survey. And so in about 36 hours, we sent out this survey to a lot of founder-focused groups and ended up with obviously a very biased selection of people who answered, but had 72% of people who said they'd had serious co-founder issues, which helped really highlight that. And even though we were the first to admit that it's a self-selecting group, that's still 34 people in 36 hours, which is a pretty good indication that it's really that widespread. So with that, what we're going to do is do a quick poll of people in the audience just so we have a sense of who you are and what you're looking to find out, and then we're going to go into introductions. So first question, how many of you guys here are either startup founders or thinking about starting a company? Awesome. How many of you have had or are currently going through co-founder disputes? Fantastic. How many of you are investors who have seen or have seen co-founder disputes help bring a company to its demise? Okay. And how many are here just to rubberneck, which is also cool? Okay, awesome. No, that's really helpful. So we're going to get started, starting with Orion right here. Quickly go through, everyone's going to give a little bit of a background to their story just for context, and then we're going to come back around and talk about one or two lessons learned before jumping into the Q&A. So do start thinking about questions, because I think that'll be the interesting part.
Thanks, Alex. Hi, I'm Orion Marks. First of all, I just wanted to thank all my co-panelists for helping me make this panel awesome and set it up, and give a special thanks to Rachel Sklar here in the first row for helping convince me to do it in the first place. Obviously, it's a bit of a daunting topic, and a big part of why we're doing this is because we really want to try and break the taboo of not talking about startup failures and acknowledge just how common they are. What sent me down this path was about 4 years ago, I spent maybe about a year and a half of my life working on a startup of my own design, 8 months of which I spent with my co-founders that I brought on, guys that I had known from high school and previous work experiences. And we were a pretty close team. We worked on a product that was able to get us into Y Combinator, super exciting. And then in the process of me trying to clarify my role as CEO, you know, how I intended to work during the summer while we were at Y Combinator, I sort of caused a major fissure amongst my partners in terms of focusing on writing code versus doing networking and that sort of thing. And it was able to spiral out of control so fast that within 2 weeks of getting the offer, we had totally trashed the company. And had to go separate ways. And guys I've known since high school, I haven't talked to since. Also more recently, I was hoping to come on this panel to be all excited about a recent endeavor, the last couple months of mine, trying to get things right this time. But that also just totally fell apart over sort of personal, co-founder, different perspective issues. What I'm going to say in that case is the silver lining is that was about 3 months worth of work. So I'm failing faster, which is, I think, good.
Sure. Hi, I'm Seth. About 5 years ago, I started a company with a coworker of mine in another company. We quit our jobs. We dove into this full time. We raised a bunch of money, but before we raised the money, we had some very clear discussions about what it meant to actually have a startup, be partners, raise money, take money, have responsibilities, have teams, and actually get out there and build a lasting business. And he really understood. And he was just, he was so emphatic about how much he understood everything about startups and what it meant and what it took and what the sacrifices were. And then, does anyone remember what happened about September of 08 when the economy tanked? Well, all his understanding went out the window. Everything we had talked about, everything we had agreed upon, his priorities changed. For very noble reasons, he had a wife and kids and was afraid of feeding his family, and he should have been afraid of feeding his family, but the understanding went away, and the end result was he resigned from the company, and we could not move forward after that. I spent a year of my life trying to resurrect the company and bring it back from the grave, and it just wasn't problem. It wasn't possible. And the bigger problem here was actually that I should have fired him long before it ever came to a head and the economy tanked, but I wasn't able to because I felt he was entitled to his role as CTO and co-founder because he brought the tech in, he was driving so much of the innovation. And that was the real problem there, is just accepting my role and doing the right thing that was the hard thing, and maybe ending the company a whole lot sooner.
Great. I'm Catherine Minshew. I now run a company called The Daily Muse, but about a year and a half ago, in early 2010, I started a company with three other co-founders, three women, all colleagues and people I thought I knew reasonably well. Two of us went full-time, one went part-time, and one kept her like 90-hour-a-week, very intense job, and would send kind of a check-in email every 2 weeks. So about 8 or 9 months of eating ramen, you know, working all the time, kind of traditional hustle. And it was fine while we were really small, but we finally hit an inflection point in April, May of last year, started to grow very quickly. And at that point in time, the MIA co-founder came back and said, guess what? I'm ready to come on full time. You know, I'd like to have 30% of the company and I need to be CEO. And the discussions went downhill from there. We thought we came to a resolution at one point. We had about a 4-week kind of grace period, and then essentially, we're kind of served basically a lot of legal papers, legal threats. I was asked to leave my own company. My team was shut out of their email addresses. There was an article published in the press on Forbes containing a bunch of things that weren't true. So I'll go into more details later, but I have a lot of thoughts on things we could have done differently, and in particular, how to kind of recognize signs that someone may not be happy with their role, that someone may only be satisfied with their role because you're not as successful as they think you may be. And when you hit that inflection point, when you do start to succeed, you are sometimes see, you know, large chasms where there had been brief cracks before.
And I'm Vivek Sharma, and I have two stories of co-founder issues, and they both ended very differently. The first one was my first startup that I did myself back in 2004. And this was a mobile social network when that wasn't very common back then. The only other companies doing something like this were Dodgeball and Socialite in New York City. And I found this doctoral student, and he was doing some really interesting research on what you can infer about people's behavior. And you know, he was going to get his PhD. And we met and got really hit it off and said, hey, let's commercialize this. Let's make a business out of it. And off we went, and I started building out the rest of the team. I should have really dug in a little bit deeper, because my first mistake was that he didn't have a full-time commitment from day one. You know, he was committed to completing his doctorate, and that was sort of the top priority, and this was a side project. Second thing, he was an academic, and he wasn't familiar with sort of the hustle required from the startup world. Third, it was probably the biggest screw-up was when we set up the equity. We kind of were afraid of the VCs. Hey, they're going to, you know, fire us, and, you know, we won't invest so much in the company. And so we sort of started the vesting date in an earlier period and didn't have a cliff or anything like that. And so this became a really sticky situation when it became clear that his level of commitment wasn't nearly what it was for the other founders. And it really started to affect the morale of the other folks who didn't have as much of a stake in the company. And we had to have that tough conversation later on and say, look, this isn't working out. And basically part ways, and it wasn't the most amicable at the time. Learning from that experience, I had another startup more recently, and the first sort of iteration of that startup, we talked about all this stuff. We said, hey, what are the different paths this thing could go? We're looking for a year, at least a year-long commitment from each other. And the end result was, you know, after 8 months on this initial version of the company, things didn't work out. We scrapped the idea. We started on a new business. And he, you know, he decided to kind of walk away and work on something new. But I really empathized with it. He was probably seeing more of a roller coaster than even me. He'd been through a couple startups already, you know, some relationship issues. And we really parted amicably so much that we're really good friends still. And he's starting a new company, and I would totally put money into it if he was if he would have me.
Awesome. So we're going to, before taking questions, we're going to do, you know, one or two kind of lessons learned more broadly from each of the speakers, and then we'll start taking questions.
I'm going to do four.
Typical.
Really, Orion can't count people.
I think that's why the other companies failed. One of the things that I think is really important to know is that competitors, being stealthy or not stealthy, raising money or not, none of these things are nearly as likely to kill your fledgling startup as co-founder problems. And you almost never see it on all the blogs that are out there telling you how to do the right steps to get your startup off the ground. But really, getting your team right and being able to, I think about it, you really need to get the team right for the long haul. And you know, you can always raise more money later, and there will always be new competitors later, but your team is your team. Along those lines, you really need to figure out who you work well with. And I think that's what I'm learning the most from my startup experiences, is the kind of people that I do work well with, the kind that I don't work well with. It's easier to change your product than your partners. The corollary to that is make sure that everybody on your team is not super fixated on one idea. You obviously all should love what you're working on, but as ideas change over time and you learn stuff, some people change with that and others don't, and that often causes a pretty big conflict. Some people always want to stick with the original idea no matter what, even if it's already proven to be bad. So you have to watch out for that. And lastly, for me personally, I've just seen in both my startup situations that having some members of the founding team be part-time and others full-time, to me, is always a recipe for conflict. And Seth will debate me on that a bit, but that's my take on it. So if you're part-time, you should either all be part-time or figure out how to all get to full-time as soon as possible.
Right. So my big takeaway is, frankly, CEO responsibility. And if you are a founder, specifically if you're the founding CEO, the buck stops with you, and it's got to stop with you. One of the big problems I had with my founder, with his understanding went out the window, is when we started, we had very vague discussions about what it meant. And he read a lot of blogs, and he knew what it meant in air quotes. But when it came down to reality, he wasn't faced for it because we didn't have those talks and specifics. It wasn't, there will be some money, or the conversations had been, we might not have a lot of revenue, we might have any revenue, we might not have any income some months there might not be income at all. And what the conversation needed to be, and what the conversation's been since then with my new startups has been, we might only make $3,000 a month, and some months, we might not make anything. And that money doesn't come back later. It's not a buffer. It doesn't, it's been 3 months without pay. Now we're all going to make $9,000. That doesn't happen. When it's gone, it's gone. But having specific conversations and owning that and understanding when it comes to communication between founders or with investors or employees or whomever, if there's a problem with communication, it doesn't matter who's at fault, who's to blame. You're the CEO. It's your responsibility to fix it. Bury the hatchet. Get it done. And I want to add on top of that that I felt a lot of blame that first startup experience and how it ended. And the catharsis for me in moving on was finding my own personal responsibility and going, wait, forget everything else that happened. I was the CEO. I was responsible. Here's what I did wrong. Here's what I learned. Here's how it's never going to happen again. And the world's changed.
So mine is divide and conquer. in any given startup, one of you should be the best at talking to the press. One of you should be the best at making technical decisions, or design decisions, or product decisions, or talking to investors, or whatever it is that your startup does. If you have more than one co-founder, you should clearly and sort of at the very beginning, I think, agree on where you're going to divide and conquer and what areas each of you is best at. And then you need to respect that going forward. These things are kind of easy to fudge when you're small, when you know the opportunities are small, when there's not that much at stake. But as you start to grow, and if you do start to do well, if CNN wants to interview one person, and it's a big fight over who that's going to be, that can turn nasty very quickly, or it can kind of seed resentment for later on. Or if a call needs to be made with a limited amount of time, and somebody isn't sure exactly who should make it, or two of you think that you should make it, that's something that I think leads to a lot of co-founder situations later on. You know, if you can kind of sit down honestly and you're not entirely sure that you respect your co-founder as being the best person to answer the things that they're in charge with, that might be a sign that later on the line you're headed for trouble. So I think that really dividing and conquering and making sure that as much as possible you all know where the buck stops is, for me, is the most important thing.
And my one thing is get a prenup. Right when you go into starting a new company, that's when you're really passionate about it. You're excited. You're dreaming about new ideas. You're communicating with your co-founder. That's the point in time when you talk about the outcomes that could happen. You know, everything could go fantastically well. You're both working really hard. You're intelligent. You hit it big, and you ride off and do an IPO sunset. In another case, you might be both working hard, but one of you burns out, or you know, two out of three burn out. And it just doesn't work out, but figure out what's going to happen in that scenario and how that person is compensated for their time and whether they hit that cliff. And in the final scenario, this is probably the messiest one, where both people or three people think that they're working hard and it becomes a really contested thing and you're really battling it out over the company. And you know, perhaps that's a good sign because you're both passionate about the thing that you're working on still. But you know, I try to figure out a third party, someone who can sort of arbitrate, and it can be an advisor to the company that can help sort of arbitrate between the two of you. But those three things, just talk about that very early on. It's going to save you.
Fantastic. So we're going to start taking questions. If anyone has some, come up to the mic up front. We're going to try and get to as many different topics as possible, so keep them coming.
I can hear you, but
if you speak up,
we'll repeat the question.
So I've heard kind of consistent theme that I'm going to challenge, because I've had actually a very successful sort of partner blog experience myself. One of the things that I've heard almost all of you say is come up with firm rules, whether it's the CEO is going to have big responsibility, you know, going to be where the buck stops, or decide in advance who's good at what, or work out scenarios. I guess my question is that all these things that you think about in advance, do those really get you where you need to be? Or is it more about bringing all of your personal and emotional skills to bear when trouble does happen? Because the stories that you told were much more about the personal side is falling apart. Oh, they understood everything until it hit the fence, right? But then the takeaways that you said were all have a prenup, decide in advance, all this kind of stuff, which does not seem to me like it would have actually prevented any of the bad scenarios that you were just describing. So, curious to hear your response.
So, I am actually not a huge believer in getting everything written out in advance as a way to actually prevent stuff from happening. Why I think it's important is because it's much more likely to surface the issues that are going to surface 10 months from now at the beginning. So for me, it's much more about the exercise. Similarly to in the business plan movement, like nobody says, you know, nobody really cares about, you know, writing a business plan anymore to submit one, but working on one is a great exercise for your business.
I would add that there's certain people you're going in co-founding with that it probably wouldn't have worked out just because the situation wasn't right, that both of you really hadn't talked about what you're looking for, and you sort of had a misunderstanding about that. And it, as was just said, it sort of surfaces that much earlier, so you can catch it and figure out that, hey, we really shouldn't be co-founding something. You don't really want to start a company. You want to go do this other thing. Secondly, I think the objectives can be something that's talked about, and the way you get there can change, right? Like someone is, hey, I'm passionate about this. I want to get a company to at least this point to prove it to myself and sell it to Google. Okay, that's, you know, we know what your goals are. We know what you're sort of looking for. And there's also got to be a period of time that you're willing to commit to that relationship to make that happen. There's that saying that no war plan survives first contact with the enemy. Kind of true here too, but at least you know what you're dealing with and you make a commitment to your partner about, hey, things might change, things will be different, we'll see challenges, ups and downs, but here's what I owe you, here's what you owe me, and in between, let's just communicate really well with each other and we know where we're coming from.
Yeah, and it could also blow up. I had the prenup, but it was done poorly, and it actually cost the company to be unresurrectable. We had an initial IP agreement that basically valued the IP of the company at $500,000. And when my co-founder left, he said, okay, great, you've got 60 days to buy back my unvested stock. We couldn't buy it back at such a valuation, and we couldn't get investment with him holding 50% of the company. So the prenup matters, but doing the prenup smartly matters much, much more. And, you know, everything can go either way, right? You know, it's your mileage may vary, may be the most understated and most simplistic thing to say, but also every situation is different. But the more ground rules you can have, or at least be aware of, and when you have the ability to figure out when there is a problem, how can we determine a solution, or how can we move beyond it? If you don't have documents at all, you're in just a shit show, and it can go legal, it can go in just horrible, horrible directions. But if you have that document, worst case is, look, the company is dead because we can't buy it back, but we have equity, it's done, and you move on, you can't really attack each other in a worse
way. Is a quick point on that.
The last thing I'll tack onto this is...
I'll just comment that in my personal experience, we, sort of structured as an LLC, had a very loose operating agreement, and I feel like that would turn out to be a huge win
There was no number set. There was no expectation. It was a win because I was willing to be patient. My partner went through a divorce, and there was we had one of the biggest business decisions we made, which was to move our data center 700 miles away. Was stuff that was done because of him, but I felt like the flexibility of not having too many things in place and having a very clear understanding that in order to make any big changes, we were going to have to come to consensus. And that was really the only thing that was really set in stone, was we agreed whatever would happen, we were going to need to come to consensus.
I think, and just to add on, I think what's important is to have that consensus in writing. My case is a little bit potentially more extreme, but we didn't really have documents for my company. And this was a company that I put all of my savings into, which was about $20,000. I was running as co-founder and CEO for about a year. And when our kind of communication started to break down, we started to use, suggest mediation, et cetera. And we ran into a situation where simply one person said, you can all go screw yourselves. And I have a whole bunch of pieces of paper that look like this with signatures on them that say we split equity in this way and we run the company in this way, and it's got my signature and it's got her signature and it's got everyone else's signature. But unless I want to take that to a court of law, there's very little else that you can do. And I think that was something that was surprising. I thought to myself, well, we made an agreement and we put it on paper like this, so we all signed it, that's good. The problem is, if any of you have ever encountered the legal system, you have to put up around $40,000 to file an injunction or to file a claim. And so if you don't want to put up around $40,000 and go through the legal process, you best have you best have good documents. And again, I think you can easily run into a situation with assets, et cetera.
Next question. Yeah.
We can talk about this, I think, a little bit later.
I'll just do.
Whereas a company like a hosting provider, et cetera, like they want to see your documents. And if this is your document, they're not going to take it. And you can get into some really, really difficult situations with assets where I literally had to walk away with nothing, because we didn't have even a basic prenup.
Next question.
My question is regarding kind of like starting solo and how hard will that be? Can you actually hire the labor instead of co-founding? Like if you need technological support, can you hire that? Would that be cheaper to do something like that? Or would it be too much work to actually, you know, probably you design one part and then hire the rest?
Okay, so just to make sure I understand, you're asking about hiring either employees or contractors versus co-founding people.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. Instead of invest, like, yeah, pretty much, like I have started companies like without co-founders, and you know, like the idea of losing the co-founder. I mean, is it possible to lose the co-founder, or is not possible, or what will be the waste of actually losing the co-founder and doing it by yourself?
Look, it depends what you're trying to accomplish, but a lot of time when you outsource, you have to have a full-time employee just to manage the outsourced people. And you know, it's just going to be where your costs are and where do you excel as a business? Who do you really need on your team to take it to the next level? And what's just the grunt labor you're looking for? Is it a simple input, simple output, in which case, who cares? But if it's something like, if it's something that's truly vital to your business, if you're a technology business and you're outsourcing your tech, that's pretty crazy. Not impossible, but crazy.
But I think that depends on how core the tech is. Like, there are a lot of things right now that are technology businesses that aren't creating a tech that's, you know, patentable or specifically revolutionary. For me, it depends on who it is. Like, I think if you find somebody who is willing to commit to the business as much as you are, who seems like they really have the skills that are required for a really core area, then you can bring someone on as a co-founder, because you do get a level of commitment and sort of side-by-sideness, but with a very, very clear agreement, and only if that's something that you want to do. I've also worked with people who are, you know, very, very valued as long-term members of the team, but are not co-founders. I think that can work really well as well, as long as you're kind of all clear on what the relationship is, et cetera. Yeah.
I would argue outsourcing disasters is a much longer panel than startup disasters. So just be careful.
Yeah, I think it's inadvisable if you're a first-time founder to not have a co-founder. And the reason is, it's not just about, oh, I need this piece of technology done, or I need this marketing done. You don't know what those problems are going to be. And having someone you can bounce this off who's complementary to you is going to make the sum greater than the parts. And not just that, the emotional roller coaster you'll go through, to go through that alone is incredibly difficult. And having a co-founder to sort of level you out and sort of talk you off the edge is really important, and it kind of bonds you through that process too. So I just wouldn't do it if I was doing, you know, first-time co-founder without a co-founder.
So I agree that there's a lot of struggle going your own. I worked on a startup for sort of the couple years in between these two cases, just primarily on my own with support from some other people who were not, you know, full-time on the thing and not, you know, co-founders with me. And it's really hard. And I think it really depends on your personality and whether you, you know, are very execution oriented, and, you know, get through 1,000 tasks a day or not. That said, I am really unhappy with the direction of the startup world and all of the incubator programs focusing on creating this idea that only startups with more than one founder are, you know, worth investing in and worth supporting. I think that severely undermines our ability to really sort of identify talented, unique individuals and support them. It would be really interesting to me to see an incubator program focused solely on sole founder startups. And the fact that that's used as a criteria for eliminating you, I think, is a poor decision.
So an observation and a question. The observation, having started a few companies, is get good lawyers. Yes. By that I mean, do not use your next door neighbor's brother-in-law who does real estate law. It's like the big firms that do venture deals all day, every day, and do startups are the ones to use, because they know this stuff. The other one is a question. I'm advising a company right now, and their cap structure basically looks like they've got two founders who had 35% each, and then they got some angel investors who had about 30% of the company, and one of the founders bailed before his vesting cliff. So they've now got a situation where they've got basically 35% of unvested stock in a stock pool, and a founder who now owns, instead of the founders owning 70% of the company, the founder owns just over 50% of the company. And I'm just wondering, what do you do with the unvested stock when a founder bails? Do you allocate it to the other founders? How have you guys thought about handling that?
Is this before investors come in, or?
Well, no, when you've got, before investors come in, it's kind of easy because it just sort of, but after you've got angel investors in or external investors in, have you thought about that in documents? Have you guys encountered that before? I hadn't encountered this before. And
I have. I don't know, Vivek, have you?
Or I've done it before, seen it before the investors came in. And, you know, in that case, you don't hit the cliff. The cliff to me is that one-year commitment you're making to your co-founders, that you're going to give it a real go and not, you know, bail after 6 months. And I think it's a really important thing to have. So it's pretty straightforward. If there's no, you know, it goes back sort of ratably to both co-founders, and you know, you split that with whatever ratio you have divided the company at. Post investors,
yeah.
I don't
so
experience with that.
What we've done with my current startup is there are three of us, and we literally have a pool stock that we've called founder stock, and we've got it in our founders agreement that if a founder leaves, the other co-founders have the right of repurchase before the company. But then if the other founders don't repurchase, then the company can repurchase. And that's been fine, but we haven't had a VC pour through that document and ask us to throw it out yet. So your mileage may vary, ours may vary. But it's clean, it works, so.
Any other questions at the moment? So one of the things.
Got a mic coming to you.
We'll make it easy for you.
Hello? Okay. In terms of decision-making structure, I hear Catherine's point about, you know, divide and conquer. And so I guess I went through a very similar scenario where we had, like, tech, like, editorial, and, like, CEO position. At what point, who makes that final decision? Because I'm also hearing from Seth that the buck stops at the CEO. So if you have people that you're empowering as co-founders to make a technical decision, but if other teammates disagree with it, what was your experience in kind of working that out? Because I felt like I encountered that kind of scenario and we weren't sure, like, who had that final vote, I guess.
Nothing will kill morale faster than a CEO saying the buck stops with me and then overruling a subordinate. So while you can be... the buck stopping with the CEO or with the founder, however it is about taking responsibility and saying, okay, you guys have disagreements, and helping them reach an agreement. Or saying, hey, look, here's exactly how we split up responsibility. It's Catherine's call, it's not mine. But you've got to own that and accept that. But it's your responsibility to make sure it's adhered to. And I don't know if I need to say anything more about that. Anyone else want to...
Yeah, I mean, the way we've divided the current company is anything on the engineering side, I trust my co-founder that he will make the right choice, and frankly, I'm not going to argue about architecture and that sort of thing, even though I was an engineer, and if I feel strongly, you know, I'll make a case for something. And likewise, he will trust me on the business side, and we jointly decide on product. And if we can't come to terms on that, then, and if I can't convince him, he can't convince me, then, you know what, we kind of both need to be on board, because that's pretty fundamental to the company.
Yeah, just to echo, I think, you know, there's usually an inertia, which is what happens, I think, if you can't agree, which obviously nobody wants for the most part. But for example, right now with the Daily Muse, if it's in, you know, certain areas, it's my decision. If it's in other areas, it belongs to each of my co-founders, and we've kind of set those out. And if there really is an area where we can't agree, I think then, you know, you assuming it doesn't belong to something, the answer then is the default steady state.
Have we answered your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Next question.
Hi. I have a quick question about just like what the steps are, because there's so much to do, it seems like, in having this conversation and then drawing up an agreement and getting lawyers involved, and it's like, how the hell do you know what to do when?
So I feel I completely feel you, because that's one reason that we didn't do an agreement in my first company for so long, is it seems like there's a lot going on. One of the first things I recommend is getting one or two mentors or advisors. They don't have to be formal advisors. It's literally anyone who's been through, you know, preferably more than one startup, or at least a long enough time with one startup, to sit down and kind of talk to the team about what's reasonable. Because I think a lot of times, especially with first-time founders, you get expectations that aren't reasonable, like, I'll be gone for the first year of the company and then come in, but I bring something special, therefore I get like half. And you know, somebody who has been through a couple startups can be like, well, this is why you should think about it a different way, or this is why you can consider this vesting structure, which someone on here in a second had a really good idea. But then I think it's important to then have a discussion, you know, without, sort of with just the team, in which you kind of realize what it is that you have to decide, and you make those decisions. And it's definitely not easy, and it's frustrating because it takes time away from building the company, which is what you want to be doing, which is why you're doing this in the first place. But I think it, you know, once I'd been through it once with the Daily Muse, we just forced ourselves really early on to have conversations, set deadlines, and you know, and then have a lawyer who walks you through that process, because it is really helpful. There's a lot that you might not think of or you might not know, and it seems so unlikely, and yet, I mean, it's there's so many people who lose everything they've worked on for a year because of just the inability to agree with others that you really think that you'd never possibly, you know, end up sitting there with them screaming, I will ruin you.
One note from the survey that we did, of the people who had co-founder issues and situations, 80% of them were first-time founders. And over 95% of them, it also only happened to them once. Now, it can again happen again, but I think a lot of what we see is it happens to you the first time because no one, you don't know how, and everyone does their best, but by leaning on the community that's gone through it before, I think that can help.
And you have attorneys who deal with many startups. You know, you've got Cooley, Wilson Sonsini, Fenwick & West, you know, the list goes on of people, of firms that do this day in and day out. Don't go with the biggest firm in your parents' hometown, or you know, your dad knows a partner, whatever it is. Just go with a player who does this day in, day out. Let them advise you and listen to the advice.
I just want to say read a lot. We're really lucky because in the past couple of years, you know, there's been just such a proliferation of material on these topics, right? And so read a lot, realize that 80 to 90% of it is wrong, and then, you know, figure out what makes sense for you. Another caveat to that is make sure that if you're the one doing all the reading and you have partners, that they are supportive of that. I was sort of going over some notes of blog post I wrote after my first startup failure, and one of the issues that came up was that my partner had problems with me spending too much time reading those stupid blogs. We were building a blog reader, but so that was a little confusing to me. There's the caveat.
Last thing I was going to say is that some lawyers will defer fees. So it's not unusual for lawyers that are used to dealing with really early stage startups to say, you know, your first X thousand dollars worth of fees we'll collect when you raise financing. That also really takes the burden off thinking that every time you go back to your lawyers for another question about some term, you're incurring, you know, $600 an hour when you can't pay it. So that's something that, you know, not everybody does, but I really recommend it. It let us just focus on getting to the best possible agreement and not on, you know, minimizing funds, which, again, it's like a couple thousand dollars to work with really good lawyers to get an airtight agreement, or not airtight, but as good as possible. And it can just save you so much time and money and heartache.
I would get an operator. I personally would get the operator who's been in your shoes. The lawyer can get the document together, but get the advice from someone who's been in your shoes and done this a couple times. Secondly, this is good training for you because you're going to do deals with companies and partnerships and that sort of thing, and you will have the legal document, but if it ever comes to that, you never want it to come to that. There's a trust that's built while you're negotiating and while you're having this kind of conversation, and it tells you a lot about the other person. So it'll protect, it's a safety net that you come to, but it's good training for doing that kind of thing later anyway.
And if your co-founders don't want to do this, which was the case in my first company, find somebody who you all respect and ask them, like, do you think this is important? And they'll probably be like, oh my goodness, yes. And they'll be like, hey, can you sit down with us and just like slam all of us into the ground about how important this is? So at the very least, somebody other than me is saying, we need to have this agreement. We need to protect ourselves. We need to talk about these things.
And walk away if you can't get that agreement done.
Yeah, if they don't want to do the agreement, like, that is an actual big problem. And you can say, like, well, they're just focused on other things, or we're really all busy, but you know, if it takes you, like, 8 months and you're, again, $20,000 in and you still don't have that agreement, there is probably a reason, and it's honestly probably because there is something that will come out if you have those honest discussions that they just don't want to surface. And even if they don't think that it's really a big deal, like, you don't want to find out, you know, a year in that they really just think that this thing is theirs and they're not going to give it to the company or whatever it is. If it's that bad, it's probably a problem.
And there's even a little bit of...
We're moving to the next question. I'm cutting you off.
Thank you.
We only have 15 minutes left, and there's a lot more that we can cover. Please, go ahead.
Okay, Tess. You guys have really... It's a great panel.
Thank you.
Very informative for folks. I'm certainly curious about some bit about your background, because it sounds like the School of Hard Knocks. You're talking about positions like CEO and CIO, and like your business acumen is there. And I'm curious, is it just fail big and fail often, or is it school... You know, again, the School of Hard Knocks, or... What do you think of business school? Have you guys all had, did you finish any college education? Is it something that you just grew? Can you tell us a little bit about your backgrounds and what folks can, where they can go if, like, question of how do we do this and how do I know what a CEO is responsible for and you know, how do I set up set up the business structures?
So I was an international relations major, which teaches you very little about business. I worked for McKinsey & Company, which is a management consulting firm, for a couple of years, and then went and led a vaccine introduction in Rwanda, which is actually a really good sort of practice for being CEO of a startup, because you've got a lot of players running around, and it's kind of crazy, and you're sort of trying to move forward and get consensus. But I would say what I really wish I'd done is work in somebody else's startup, because I think you bust a lot of myths about the glories of startup life and the problems you encounter if you have some experience either consulting for or being around or working in startups. In my case, I spent about a year in the first company in which we were super unsuccessful. I did not know what we were doing, but we were learning, and it was just massive trial and error, mostly error. But you do come out, if you come out of the other end and you're still going, you usually feel like you can survive anything.
I was a CS undergrad. I moved out to the Valley right after school. Worked at Cisco, and that was the last big company ever. It was like 9 months. I hated it the entire time. Sorry if anyone here is from Cisco.
He means that. He's sorry.
I could only do... startups were the only thing for me, and I found that out by joining a 20-person company where I was one of the first engineers, and they blew it up in like 2.5 years to a 1,000-person company, and I really saw how companies are built and how management teams are put together and different organizations sort of work together like that. And it was an incredible learning experience. And I think if you're not doing a startup yourself, definitely consider joining one, because your learning is fast-tracked so much. So I did that, and then I did this mobile startup, which didn't play out as I planned. And I think for a lot of people, your first startup, there's a good chance it may crater, because you're going to make a lot of mistakes, and hopefully the good stuff you're doing is balancing out the horrible mistakes you'll make. There's something that I hope we're going to talk about too, is what happens post-failure after you've failed at a startup, and sort of the real lows that hit and the depression, and you know how you sort of pick yourself up after that. And so I went to another startup and I was kind of hard on myself and said, you know what, I was an engineer, maybe I can't sell. So I went selling for a company for a couple of years, and in that time I learned that, yeah, you know what, I actually can, and I did really well there. And then I said, I've got to go do another startup again. And so this is my fourth startup. And it's just a lot of fun. I can't imagine doing anything else.
I'll just speak really quick. I have a computer science background from the University of Michigan. I don't think that has particularly helped me that much. I mean, I have a career as a programmer, and I think that day-to-day experience of working on a lot of client projects, which is what I did for a long time, was very helpful. The CEO in the startup that I was just working on for the last 3 months had an MBA from Cornell. I think he's a really smart guy, but he was also part-timing it with us, and I really needed to look to him to help resolve the disputes between me and the third partner, and that just really didn't happen quickly enough, until we got into a rut. So, I'm not sure that education, you know, on the whole is all that important. I think that getting into the trenches and experience is important. That said, these guys have mentioned working at a startup, and probably one of the biggest regrets that I have is never having worked at a, you know, what I would consider a real startup myself. That probably would have helped me a lot, but I always just wanted to go and start doing it myself right away. So that's.
I will jump in for 10 seconds. I've got a very,
well,
got a very different.
You keep getting kicked. Go ahead.
No, because I'm the one. I was in college. I was actually triple majoring in math, physics, and computer science because I'm fucking out of my mind. But I actually ended up taking a leave of absence from college. Ended up getting hired by a startup, and I've never had a chance to go back and finish. And I've just been startup after startup after startup, and having a blast and doing my own. And I can't work well for anyone else, so I guess I have to work for myself. So I that's how it goes.
Especially, I think there was a question before Rachel.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
So first off, thank you for speaking so openly about this. So losing a co-founder can be particularly stressful for teams. So what advice do you have on just keeping morale high during co-founder separation and then afterwards?
Don't ask Foursquare.
on my first startup, we actually started with, we were four co-founders. And one of them left after several months because he was recently married and had a mortgage, and you know, realizing that it was going to take us longer to raise money than, you know, he actually really was comfortable for, he was getting very stressed out, and that was sort of rubbing off on the team. And he decided to leave. After which point, morale for the whole team, for the rest of the team was definitely lower, which was part of why I, at that point, decided to push for, you know, why don't we try applying to Y Combinator, because they had thrown that idea around before, and I wasn't really thrilled about doing it, but at this point, you know, I said, I need to do something to pick up the morale of my team, so let's try going down that road. It's hard, I guess, you know, losing one member. I don't know if anybody can speak to like a success. Actually, you can,
yeah.
Vivek.
So
right?
On the more recent startup, we lost one of our co-founders, and the other one was about to bail. He was being poached by a very successful New York startup, and we were just starting. It was a dream. It was nothing. We had no money, and I had to show him there was something real that we were chasing. And so I said, look, I know you have this other offer. I want you to consider continuing to do this. Don't believe me, come into a couple sales meetings with me where I'm basically pitching a deck, vaporware, and look at the reaction of the people when they start talking about this. And so we did that a couple times with a couple large companies, and he was like, yeah, you know what, we should really give this a go. And it worked out.
Awesome. Next question. Whatever. Yeah.
Hello. My name is Dave Hecker, and I'm with SageWing. I'm on the other side of the outsourcing for startups debate. My company provides lean outsourcing services to startups. So we're seeing tons and tons of startups that can't find technical co-founders. They need interim CTO services until they find co-founders, and there's lots of work. But still, the huge aversion on startups are doing outsourcing. And I certainly agree that most outsourcing is botched. Elance sucks. It's a nightmare. People lose a lot of money, and we have an answer to that. But what do you think are the main challenges, sort of emotionally, sales-wise, facing companies that want to do outsourcing to startups and have a real value proposition to do it? How do we fight the aversion to it? Why does everybody hate outsourcing for startups?
It depends what your core competency is. And if you're a technology company, I think you can't just look at that as a piece of work that needs to get done and let me, you know, write the spec and have someone do it for me, because that conversation that happens around what you're building and what you learn from that and the push-pull between engineering and sales and design and your whole team makes it bigger and truer, right? You kind of find that product market fit in that process. We do outsource our, you know, kind of financial work. We have a virtual CFO that does that kind of stuff for us. It's not a core competency for our company, but technology is, sales is, and we would never outsource it.
Next question.
All right, so I know all you guys. This isn't actually about your issue, but as you guys know, I run a listserv for women. And recently, something that came up was the notion of starting a business with your significant other. And the sort of the list sort of came alive with discussions for and against. I personally know of two co-founder disasters that happened because the co-founders working intensely together, building this thing together, ended up going down a path that was not perhaps the best path for both of them. I mean, they ended up sleeping together. So, I mean, this isn't your issue, but in your research and your thinking on this, I do think that this is an element that should at least be raised in this forum. So I'm curious about what your thoughts are.
Comment on significant others and or interpersonal relationships of the romantic or sexual kind with co-founders.
Bad idea.
I've only ever had female co-founders, so it hasn't been an issue. But I feel like, you know, in work at least, you can work on different teams, or you can, you know, you can leave a company if you sleep with a coworker and it goes bad. In a startup, you have so little escape, and it's, you know, there's so much at stake that I think a couple people do it and they do it really well, but I think you have to do it knowing what you're going into it with.
Okay, so we have about 5 minutes left or so, and there were a couple things we want to make sure to touch on if questions hadn't been asked about it. I'm going to limit two of you guys per answer, so I will cut you off. The first is on controlling the narrative and kind of what happens if the situation is public. Should it be public? Should it be private? Catherine, I'll let you touch on it first, and then I know we'll see who wants to take it next.
I mean, I think this is a really tricky issue because obviously a lot of people who are going through a co-founder situation really don't want anyone to know. In fact, one of the things that I think is actually frustrating around the issue is that there is this kind of shame sometimes associated with it. Sometimes when I tell people in any way, if I reference that I've had a co-founder issue, they're like, oh, well, don't tell anyone that. You know, you should really keep that under wraps. Like, it's this really bad thing. I kind of disagree, and it's partially because of the experience that I had. When my co-founder situation was happening, it went public very quickly in a way that I didn't intend but kind of had to contend with. Part of what was happening is I've been running a company as CEO and co-founder for about 10 months, and so as such, I was receiving around 200 company-related emails a day to my company email. And within about an hour or so of things kind of taking a very swift, sharp turn, my email inbox was cut off. Not redirected, not, you know, hidden. It was just, everything was just bouncing back. So my Facebook wall started filling up with, hey, Kat, oh, and our website was completely taken offline. So my Facebook wall starts filling up with, Catherine, your emails are all bouncing back, what's going on? People start tweeting, Catherine, your emails is like bouncing back, the website's down, like, what the heck is happening? And so I made the decision to basically email about 150 of the people that I was in close contact with and give them a relatively honest version of what was happening, which is not the path a lot of people take. I spent about 3 hours writing an email. I BCC'd everyone, obviously, and I said, I'm very disappointed to let you know that this morning my company's website went down, my email went down with it, as well as the emails of my co-founder and COO, my managing editor, and the entire social media, web, communications, technology, and editorial teams. This was done without my knowledge, you know, by two of my co-founders. I'm trying to resolve the situation, but until then, you can reach me at this Gmail account. Thank you so much for supporting the company, and I hope to work with you all again in the future, basically. And I sent it to about 150 people, and then I almost vomited. And, you know, it's funny. I got back probably 130 responses. I'd say maybe 10 of them were, who did you send this to? You really shouldn't tell people this. Like, keep this on the down low. I'll help you hide it if necessary. About 60, maybe about 30 of them were, oh my God, the same thing has happened to me, let's talk. About another 30 were, oh my God, this happened to my really good friend, or this happened to someone that I know, or I know someone who just went through this, like, do you want to talk? And then a lot of the others were just like, that's really tough, it happens a lot, like, let me know if I can do anything to help. And I think for us that was really, really powerful, because when you start a company, you put your heart and soul into it, and the number one thing is, I didn't want anyone to think that I was walking away from this company because, like, I didn't feel like running it anymore. I felt like I had put my personal relationships on the line, and I had, you know, connected with all of these people who were involved with the company and said, you know, this is my company, I'm running it, let's set up a deal, let's set up a partnership. We had all sorts of things that were in progress. And for me, it wasn't an acceptable answer to put out this nice, quiet story of how, like, I suddenly decided to go in a new direction. I understand some people do that, and I think that it's, in a lot of cases, a really smart move. But I also would say if things are going really bad, there is some value to controlling the narrative and to saying, I'm going to be honest about what's happening. You guys know that this happens with co-founders. And then when essentially my company's website went live about 24 hours later with a brand new site that contained all of the same things, but a new name and two people behind it that nobody knew really as being associated with the startup, it was much more clear what had happened. And because of that, when I decided to start over from scratch with a new company, there were a lot of people who kind of understood and supported us. And I think it was really, it ended up being.
Catherine, I'm going to cut you off. No. Sorry, guys. We only have a couple minutes left. I know I want to orient to talk a little bit about coping and kind of the effect it can have on you personally when you have a co-founder situation.
Yeah. I mean, it actually is a segue from what Catherine is talking about. I mean, when these things go down, they really suck on a personal level, right? And we're talking about this in a very businessy way and things that you can do, you know, but at the end of the day, this is all personal people interaction issues. You know, in Catherine's case, it's awesome. They've basically just picked right back up where they were and said, well, we're gonna do this thing again and do it better than them. And that's, you know, and that's their way to get through it, and that's, you know, and that's awesome, and they are going to do it. So for me, you know, after the first thing fell apart, like I was pretty depressed, and depression is something that I've had to deal with in the past, and it's something that I'm always very wary of, and is something that I, you know, my own knowledge about myself and how I react to things influences, you know, who I do choose to work with. You know, some people can be very intense, and sometimes that really works great to, you know, to get a team going, and sometimes it doesn't, depending on your personality. So you need to acknowledge that. When it was over, I didn't want to show my face in the New York tech community at all, where most of us are from New York. It took me, you know, a couple months to get back on my feet. I wrote a long, long, long blog post about it, and I just sort of found that being honest and open about the situation was the best thing for me to get through it, and it's a large part of why we're doing this panel.
Say one. We kind of are out of time, and want to really thank you guys for joining us, for asking such honest and candid questions, and we'll be sticking around if you guys want to come up and pick our brains on anything more specific. But thank you again.